everyone. Welcome, and thank you for listening to the On the MS podcast. This is where survivors of enthusiastic sobriety programs started by Bob Meehan and survivors really of any institutional child abuse, high control, coercive control groups and programs can come and speak their truth. And that's what we have today. So today we have Rachel. She is actually a survivor of the Hyde School. I've had a couple of them, of survivors from the Hyde School, reach out to me and want to come on the podcast and speak up and speak out, because they see that, you know, the work that we've been doing is working, it's getting attention, and they want their stories to be heard as well. And I am all for it. So any survivor of any adolescent, young adult program, boarding school, where, you know, there's coercive and high control and their tactics can be considered child abuse, you are welcome to come on and speak your truth on this podcast. So you're going to get to meet Rachel today. She is, like I said, a survivor of the Hyde School, and you can find them online at hyde.edu, and it's H-Y-D-E. And it's interesting, you know, as I'm doing some of these interviews with people who went to other institutional child abuse programs, it's interesting to go look at their websites and then the contrast between what they're showing on their websites and what their survivors are saying about the time that they spent there and their actual experience there. It's staggering. So check them out. I'm also going to link to a bunch of information. There have been a lot, you know, very similar to Bob Meehan's programs. There's been a lot of negative press about them for a long time. And it looks like some of it has had an effect, but ultimately they're still operating. They're still hurting kids. And it's, you know, it's just another another program we need to shine some light on. So I will be linking in the link tree, the On the MS pod link tree. I'll be linking to another woman's link tree that has a lot of information about the Hyde School that you can, you know, kind of go down a wormhole looking it all up. But Rachel's just awesome. And she was very open and vulnerable and talked a lot about what happened to her there and how she came out of it and what she's doing now. So I really think you're going to like it. Something I wanted to mention is we did meet our $10,000 goal for Lisa Beckers, aka Jim Jones, for her mom's GoFundMe. And we are beside ourselves with gratitude. Thank you so much to everyone who donated. What we actually did is we upped the donation amount, the goal amount, to $20,000, because once she started talking to people and hiring people to come in and help her mom, they, you know, they were like, that's great that you raised $10,000. I hope it's enough, you know, and it's just so expensive to, you know, die in the United States. It's just ridiculous. And we just want her mom to have the best, you know, end of her life experience she can have. So if you haven't donated yet, or if you can share it with your networks and your communities, please do. We're really working hard. You know, we, like I said before, we would not be where we are without Lisa and all the work that she did back in 2005. So definitely check that out. I hope that everyone had a very safe and happy holiday season. I guess that's like the last 2 weeks. And obviously, you know, we are not doing any, putting out any new episodes other than this one. This will be the last episode of 2021. So we're going out with a bang. And then coming up in January, we're going to have some interviews with professionals. So I'm going to be interviewing the therapist that I worked through a lot of my stuff with. And she's phenomenal. She actually works with adolescents. She's actually like a licensed, credited, credentialed therapist who went to school and got an education and, you know, all of that. And so we're going to talk a little bit about what like actual healthy, helpful treatment looks like for adolescents. And then what, you know, what she suggests for people coming out of these programs and programs like them to kind of get back on track and you know, kind of deal with all the trauma and all that stuff. So that's going to be great. That's going to be probably the first or second week in January. And then I have another interview I'm going to be doing. That's a surprise that I will tell you more about in the new year. And then Daniel Kolitz and I are going to do a part two. And what we're going to do is get really into the timeline. So, you know, kind of where everything started with Enthusiastic Sobriety Programs and what happened over the years. Because if anyone knows it, it's Daniel. And we might get some other people to jump on and chime in. So we're going to do that in the new year too. So I'm really, really excited for all the stuff we have planned. And hopefully the new website will be up by then. And y'all will have a place where you can go for resources and, you know, and things like that. It's going to be super cool. So anyway, so I have talked enough. I am going to turn everything over to Rachel now. So I hope you enjoy, Rachel, and I will see you on the other side. Hi, everyone. I am here today with Rachel. Rachel is a survivor from the Hyde School. I will let her tell you a little bit more about them. And so Rachel and I actually met because of Instagram. Yes. Yep. So I follow a bunch of other kind of institutional child abuse awareness accounts on Instagram. And one of them listened to the podcast and connected me with Rachel because she, you know, felt like it was time for her to speak out about her experience. And I am here for it. I am here to, you know, give anybody a platform to stop this abuse from happening to young people and their families, because it's not just Bob Meehan's programs where this kind of abuse is happening. It's happening a lot. And it's happening all over the country and all over the world. So I am super excited to have you here today, Rachel. Thank you for doing this. I know it takes a lot of strength and courage to do something like this.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. So tell us a little bit about you and, you know, kind of like the years that you were in the Hyde School and what, you know, how you ended up there, just to start off with.
Okay. So my name's Rachel. I went to Hyde Woodstock, which is actually a campus that's now closed. I got sent there in the summer of 2005 and I left in March 2008, I want to say. And yeah, the way I got sent there, wow. Thinking back on all of it, I got sent there basically for the typical, you know, being a bad kid.
Right.
Being the
all
trouble
of us bad
teen.
Kids. Yes.
Yeah, that kind of thing. My behavior, according to everyone, wasn't on par and where it should have been. So, you know, I got sent there basically for behavior reform and things of that nature that they, you know, Hyde loves to claim they can help kids with and this, that, and the third. So
right.
That's how I ended up at Hyde.
Okay. And how old were you?
I got sent there when I was 15 going into the summer. I started a summer program there. So it was the summer of my sweet 16.
Okay. So you were almost 19 when you left?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And where, like, how far is it from where you lived?
Where I lived, I live in New York City. So from where I lived, it was in Woodstock, Connecticut. At this point, I believe it was at least a 4-hour drive, I want to say, if not longer.
Okay. So not like they didn't send you across the country, but it was a hike to
get
there.
It definitely wasn't next door compared to New York City.
Right. And do you know how your parents found out about it?
To this day, I don't honestly know. I do believe it was from a private school that I was attending shortly before I got sent to Hyde. I believe it was one of those kind of educational consultant referred me kind of things. Mm-hmm. But I don't know for sure because there was a kid that also ended up at Hyde that was from that school as well. So I always wondered if there was someone, you know, some middle kind of person that was referring kids to the Hyde School.
Sure, sure. I'm absolutely sure there was.
Yeah.
I'm sure they make very glossy brochures about
Yes, they're super shiny.
how great they are. So when you say that you have behavioral problems, like what was going on? Like, were you getting high? Were you like staying out all night? Like what was going on?
It was a mix of things. I would never really think in my eyes in today's culture that, you know, what I did was that bad. But basically mm-hmm. it was, you know, I was smoking weed. I mm-hmm. would, you know, I went to this one school that they let us out for lunch and I just wouldn't come back from lunch. So I guess I was, you know, considered a truant kind of student. I got in trouble for writing a threatening letter about a teacher uh-huh. saying basically that if I was a tiger, I'd rip her throat out. But, you know, I don't really have the capability of turning into a tiger.
That is amazing.
Yeah. So it was just, you know, stupid behavioral little glitches like that, that
yeah.
ultimately, I guess, spiraled into my parents thinking that, you know, and of course, you know, the places that I was going currently before Hyde, telling them, you know, she's going to end up in jail. She's going to end up dead. Da, da, da. And
right.
so it was that kind of thing that it was, you know, we have to save your kid before the worst thing possible happens.
Yes,
to her.
Absolutely. So where were you going before Hyde? What did they try before that?
I had been a bunch of places. I went to a Rudolf Steiner school, a Robert Louis Stevenson school. I don't know if you've ever heard of those, but one of them I know is
no, I haven't.
Somewhat known. It was part of something they call the Waldorf schools. I don't really.
Oh, yeah. I'm very familiar with Waldorf schools. Yeah.
I went to one of those. I went to another one that was, I considered it very similar, called Robert Louis Stevenson, which I believe is the one that I was at previously before I got sent to Hyde.
Okay. So your parents had just been throwing you to the wolves yeah. for years. Yeah.
Yeah. They had been trying every, cause you know what it was, is I had gone to almost every public school possible and I would get kicked out for stupid things such as saying, I wish I was a tiger. I could rip a teacher's throat out kind of thing.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, so they were kind of on their last legs with where can we send this kid to go to school at this point? So it was
right.
kind of, you know, let's find the alternative private schools that may take her.
Yeah. Yeah, that's understandable. Yeah, I know it's so sad. Like parents, I mean, they just hit this point where they're like, I don't know what to do, you know, and there's yeah. so little like actual helpful information yeah. out there for parents with kids who aren't just like getting straight A's and, you know, in the chorus and having wholesome dance parties with their friends. Like for those
exactly.
of us who, you know, are a little bit, you know, off the beaten path. They especially like my mom was that kid. Like she got straight A's.
Yeah.
She rode horses. She, you know, like she was like the perfect kid. She never got in trouble. And now she's got this daughter who was just off the rails and she had zero experience with that. You know, she didn't know what mm-hmm. to do. And so she took the advice of doctors and, you know, people that she thought she could trust. And it's unfortunate that, you know, a lot of those people put themselves forth as these trustworthy advocates for your children when really there's a lot more involved that usually starts with money,
yeah.
you know, like usually starts with the bottom line. And there are people involved who do not have the kind of education to be able to properly diagnose someone and they just look at,
exactly.
you know, troubled teens, especially if drugs and alcohol are involved and they label them addicts. And then they get put into this world where it's like you said, like, well, your kid's going to die if they're an addict. Like it
yeah.
snowballs so quickly to terrifying these parents into handing over their children.
Exactly.
You
That's
know?
Actually exactly what it is. It's just terrifying
yeah.
people into, oh my God, I have no idea what else I can possibly do here. You have the answer, do something.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. It's just so sad. And I don't, you know, I don't blame the parents at all. And I'm really trying to
yeah.
find some parents who will come on and talk about their experience. But it's hard for them, you know, it's hard for them to come on because they feel so much guilt.
Yeah.
Because ultimately it was their decision, you know, and
exactly.
it's just, you know, I would love to say to all parents, like, it's not your fault, you know,
yeah.
you were taken advantage of at a very, very vulnerable time in your life and your child's life. And you were doing the best you could. So
exactly.
It's just rough. So Okay, so you get sent to Hyde. I'm actually on their website right now, and I encourage anyone listening. Gosh. It's it's hyde.edu. And I mean, their website is just gorgeous, and it makes it look like the teens are having a blast at this place.
Yep. Looks like summer camp.
Yeah, and everyone's smiling and happy. But here's something very interesting. They have this section called Hyde Students Impact the World, and there's three images, and next to the images are quotes. And so the first one says, "A lot of these experiences that Hyde made me do pushed me to get out of my comfort zone." So that's very interesting language. Hyde made me do and pushed me to get out of my comfort zone. So that's like, that's a very interesting sentence right there.
I'm actually very intrigued at the fact that they left made me in there.
Yeah. And then the second quote is, "At Hyde, I learned to expand my thinking and take hold of my humility." Which is also,
all kids say that.
Right. Well, and it's also a very interesting turn of phrase. So take hold of my humility. Like, that sounds a little bit like forced humility, which is usually closer to humiliation than it is to actual humility. So, and that's one of the, that's one of the things that enthusiastic sobriety programs do too, is like, you need to be humble, which means you need to roll over and do whatever the fuck we tell you to do, basically. Mm-hmm. So, it's a really interesting website. So let's start at the beginning. What was your experience like when you first got there? What were your first thoughts about the school?
Well, within my first 5 minutes of my interview there, I was kind of just like, I am not going here. Like, there's no way that this is happening. I'm not going to this place. This place is ridiculous. Like, this is not for me. Their interview process is really weird. I don't even know exactly how to explain it because it was kind of over a decade ago at this point.
Right.
But what I do remember is the questions that they would ask were things like, are you willing to change? Do you believe that you have to be a better person? Things of that nature, when it's like, mm-hmm. I'm 15, like what, what is so innately wrong with me at this point mm-hmm. in life that I need to be willing to change my entire being for you? Like,
right.
That was the first introduction to me being kind of like, this is
weird.
Where I want to be.
So did you go into it thinking, this is a school and I am interviewing to be accepted here? Is that what it was set up like?
Pretty much. Okay. That was the premise for it. But again, I did get sent to what they call a summer challenge program. So that was my prerequisite to the school year because I was struggling so much apparently that
The summer program first.
I did the summer program first, and then it was kind of like a student orientation, they called it, to the school year, which I found weird because since when do you need a whole summer's worth of an orientation to go to school?
Right. Well, and I wonder, do they ever turn anybody away?
According to my knowledge, no. Like, I would have been the prime candidate that you turn away when you ask a kid, are you willing to change? And I pretty much tell you to, you know, go fuck yourself.
Right.
Excuse my language, but yeah.
Oh no, you can cuss all you want. Like that,
oh, awesome. Cause I swear like a sailor.
So do I.
But yeah. So when you have a kid that basically off jump says that, I would be the prime candidate for not being accepted, but I have never actually seen anyone that came through for an interview not end up at the school.
Sure. Yeah. So it's more of a, it's more to make it seem like it's a legitimate school that you have to, like, there's this strict interview and application process. Okay. So you did your application. How did they respond to you being like, no, fuck this?
Honestly, from what I remember, the person interviewing me was pretty intrigued. Like, I think I remember discreetly someone telling me after my interview process, because we had to eat around there, that, you know, oh, I hope you didn't talk because that's how you get accepted. If you give them anything, they're going to accept you.
Oh, okay.
And I was, you know, very much so, you know, go fuck yourself. I'm not here for this. I'm not coming here.
Right.
And, right then and there, you know, it clicked. It was kind of like, oh crap, I probably got accepted because I gave them something that they could think they can break, or, you know, something right. along those lines.
Right. Okay. So you stuck around, you ate lunch, and then did you go back home and wait for the acceptance letter, or was it like the next day you were moving in?
I believe I went up, and it was probably, I want to say maybe like a week or so before we heard back, and I was up there for the summer program.
Okay. All right. So you go up there for the summer program. So where are you living?
I was still living with my parents at that point.
Okay. So were you, like, when you started the summer program, were you commuting or were you staying somewhere on campus? Okay.
Yes, I was staying on campus during the program.
Okay. So was it like a dorm? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, it was a dorming situation. So we had a girls and a boys dorm. Girls slept in one dorm, boys slept in another. And then we had like a communal dining hall, things of that sort. It was like a closed campus. So we weren't really leaving campus to do things. Everything was just on campus.
Okay. So what were the dorms like?
The dorms were awkward for me, honestly, because I'm kind of like an introverted person. Unless I'm really like you, I kind of like my space. They were very close quarters kind of living.
Yeah.
They were set up as wings of the building that they were in. So like each floor had like different wings. Like there was 4 South, 4 East, 4 West. So there were about, I want to say maybe 10 to 15 girls per floor. And typically each room had 2 girls in it, unless, you know, you had a single room, which some girls got a single room. And it was not fun for me, honestly, because I learned how gross females can be, honestly, living with a bunch of females and, being in close quarters like that. So it was not fun. I remember girls would get into fights and, you know, they'd just always be screaming. And you had to, it was really annoying to just call home. We had pay phones that we had to pay for, and to get your turn was like impossible. So imagine, you know, waiting for someone to call you. It's like, you can't even expect anyone to call you because everyone's always waiting for the phone.
Right. Did you have like ensuite bathrooms, or was it a communal bathroom also?
We had bathrooms that were communal, to like other floors. So like one bathroom would connect to 2 wings.
Oh, wow. Okay. And how many girls were on each wing?
I would say 10 to 15 at any given time.
Good God. Yeah. Okay. So you're living in a dorm. You've moved in. It's summer in New York. Did you have... Oh, sorry. Connecticut.
Yeah.
Which I know from experience, like summers up north can be just as humid as summers down south. Mm-hmm. So what was that like? Like, did y'all have air conditioning? Was it just open your windows and suck it up? Like, what was the actual like living situation like?
Yeah, it was pretty much open your windows. We were able to bring, like, for instance, if you were able to stop at Walmart beforehand, you could buy like a window fan to put in the window, something like that. But for the most part, it was, you know, fresh natural air and
right,
lots of workouts. So it was definitely not fun. I remember that summer specifically being really tough because of all the workouts that they made us do. And I was particularly always in trouble.
Right.
I was always getting, you know, the shit end of the stick kind of thing with everything. So in the middle of summer, you know, I'm always out there, you know, working out or doing, you know, child labor type stuff, you know, raking leaves, and not in the summer, but you know, you get what I'm saying. Picking dandelions was one of their favorite things to do in the spring and summer. You have to just go out there and pick dandelions all day until you can't see a single one. So that was rough. I remember that summer was kind of rough. I remember that was one of the first times actually that during one of the workouts I was having an asthma attack and I wasn't allowed to stop. And I literally almost thought I was going to die. Like I've never been that afraid since having asthma in my life before that moment.
Yeah. So tell me what like a typical day was like. Like, what time did you wake up? What did you do? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, for me, since, like I said, I was usually in trouble, it would typically be I'd have to wake up at 5:30 in the morning. We'd do like a boot camp-esque workout until breakfast. We'd have breakfast, which consisted of, you know, cold food only. You could only grab, you know, like trail mix kind of thing, cereal, what else could we have? We could have toast with butter, PB&J, you know, things like that. Then after breakfast, since I was always in trouble, I wasn't allowed to do, you know, be part of the community type thing. So kids would have a program during the day that they would follow. But when you're out to work, as they call it, you basically just do chores all day. So like, for instance, one time they had me in a building and I was literally scrubbing the tiles with a brush and a bucket of bleach. Like that was my task to do that day until the next meal. So you do things like that when you're out to work a lot. You just do tedious chores that they find for you to do around campus until your next meal. If your behavior is particularly bad that day, you get extra workouts to do. But that was generally my days.
And when you say workouts, like exercise?
Yeah, like physical workouts.
So they used exercise as a punishment?
Correct. They would call it character building, but, you know, it was obviously if I didn't, you know, for instance, I remember I was always getting hit with extra workouts because I would not participate in group accountabilities. And their group accountabilities basically were if someone in the group doesn't do something or does something wrong or, you know, whatever the reason we're getting the workout is for, everyone is now part of the punishment. So one group accountability, I was refusing to get down and do push-ups, or it was something stupid, minuscule like that. And I got a whole extra workout just because of it, just for me.
Okay. That's bonkers. So do you know how much your parents paid for this program?
Back then, I want to say it was at least 30 to 40K a year.
Jesus.
I think it was. Now I hear it's up to at least 60.
So your parents are paying $30,000 to $40,000, and you're eating peanut butter and jelly and trail mix for breakfast?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
Did any of the meals get better?
Occasionally when I was not out to work and on punishment, I was allowed to eat, you know, the hot lunch, but the food there was not very good. You know, the cooks did their best, but it wasn't gourmet food. It wasn't, you know, anything special. It was, you know, half the time it was leftovers for the week kind of thing. It wasn't anything particularly good.
So, I'm sorry. So they also used food as a punishment?
Yeah, they would use your food. Like you can't get the cafeteria made food if you're on punishment. You could only, like, for instance, I got sent to the woods. They have a property in Eustis, Maine that they own woods, like the wilderness program kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I got sent to their own program, their own wilderness program. And for instance, when I was in the woods, I could only take as much as my two hands could hold. That was how much my ration was for each week that I was there. It was how much my own two hands could hold of trail mix.
For a week?
Yeah.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
Yeah. So this much, and I have little hands, mind you.
So yeah.
My tiny hands were that much is what was supposed to, I was supposed to make it last for each week that I was there. Like each week you get a new handful, but you're supposed
trail
to
mix.
Make it last.
So you ate trail mix that you can fit in your hands over a week, and that's all you got to eat.
Correct. And they even had a fun name for it. They called it GORP. G-O-R-P, GORP.
I don't even know what to say about that.
Yeah.
And I just don't.
It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
That is disturbing. Like you can't, y'all were children and you were teenagers at a time when your body needs nourishment.
Yep.
And so how aware were your parents of all of this? Like, were you telling them this stuff? Like what was happening there?
So I would try and send letters home, but occasionally because I was so difficult in the beginning, they wouldn't let me send mail home for a little bit. So I would try and explain to my parents on the phone the few times that I would get the phone, you know, hey, you know, this is going on. I really want to come home. I don't want to be here. This is not working. There's something wrong here. And their immediate response, which I found out later, was that they were instructed when they're going to get hard phone calls from us to just tell us that, you know, they're going to call us back, you know, they have to go do something, but basically to get off the phone. So the second that I would try or I even sounded like I was going to complain as they thought of it, it was time to go.
Yeah. Yeah, that happened in the before I ended up in one of Bob Meehan's programs. I was in like an inpatient hospital, and they told my parents that too. I got like a 15-minute call once a week to my mom, and they told her, like, you know, she's gonna complain, she's gonna say she hates it, and that's normal, and, you know, just tell her that, you know, you want the best for her and you love her, and that it's good, you know, it's going to get better, and that's why she's there, and, you know, all of that. So yeah, so now you're in this position of like, nobody's listening to me.
Exactly.
And it kind of kills your spirit. I mean, it's very,
it does.
Yeah,
God, it really does.
Okay, so how long were you doing the wilderness thing?
So I got sent there a few times, actually, but each time I went there, I was there for about 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks at a time. I think I got sent a total, they make you go during the summer programs. So besides those, I think I got sent maybe 2 or 3 more times, maybe 4.
Okay. I'm looking at, oh, wow. I'm trying to see if they have like, do they even have like a doctor or anything on staff?
From my time there, no, there was nobody that was actually licensed there. I have heard from recent students, though, in recent years, that they've had at some point a licensed social worker, but I'm not aware of them currently even staffing anyone licensed.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's one thing if this is really a school.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to me that it seems like behavioral health and working with troubled kids is one of the things that they claim to do, yet they don't have like a psychiatrist or a counselor, nothing on staff. So nope. What, like, were there staff, like, did you have kind of like a dedicated staff member? Like, who worked with you on behavioral stuff?
So we didn't really actually focus on like per se, like therapeutic behavioral approaches or anything that you would typically see like from a psychiatrist or, you know, a therapist or anything of that sort. Mm-hmm. We had what they called our wing parents and our discovery group leaders. So your discovery group while you're there is supposed to be, how can I say it? It's supposed to be like your makeshift family, they say.
Okay.
So your discovery group is a bunch of kids thrown into a group with, it was typically 2 faculty, mind you, that are just, they could be your math teacher, they could be your science teacher, they could just be your gym teacher, you know, just a regular teacher, nobody licensed or anything. And what Discovery Groups does is that's basically where you discuss all your shit. So in Discovery Group meetings, we call them disco groups, everyone, they'd make you dredge up all your traumas, everything you've ever been through up till that point, the worst things that you've done, and just, They make all these kids talk about all their traumas, you know, their worst indiscretions in their life, this, that, and the third. And there's no real outcome to it. There's no help with it. It's just, let's just throw all this shit out there. And then that's the end of disco groups for today. But what they do is they have these things they call concern meetings, which are basically everything that's happened in your discovery groups. There's that core group of people that know all this deep shit about you that now can lash out at you and publicly humiliate you with it. So in concern meetings, that's basically what it is. It's a place where someone can say, I think, you know, and I had them a lot, I think Rachel needs a concern meeting. And it's just people telling me, you know, that, you know, your mom hates you or you hate your mom because you're adopted and this, that, and the third. And, you know, they just fling everything back at you. Or any judgment they have at you, this is their time to just throw it at you. But out of all of this, there is no outcome. There's no treatment per se. There's no actual help with it. So behavioral health was kind of like a joke at Hyde. Like there was no behavioral health, basically. You know what I mean? Like there was no, I remember my senior year, actually, I had requested to see a therapist because I thought I was genuinely going insane with what happened that year. And I was suddenly, the only option that I had was a former parent. She was a holistic trauma therapist, and that's who I was assigned to speak to.
Okay, what's a holistic trauma therapist? What does that look like? Like, does she have any kind of actual education? Like, what is that?
That I don't know at that point, but basically what we would do are these like therapeutic, like we did this thing called the tapping maneuver, the tapping technique.
Oh yeah. EFT.
EFT. So like she was the closest to someone licensed or clinically licensed that I ever came, but I always found it weird that she was a former parent as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I was never able to really truly be as open as I really wanted to be because of her being a former parent.
Yeah, because of her involvement. Yeah. Yes, listeners, look up what does EFT even stand for?
I forget at this point. I know it had something to do with trauma-based eye facial technique or something like that.
It's a bunch of bullshit is what it is. All right, yeah. Let's see. Emotional freedom technique. That's what it's called. Yes,
that's what it was.
I was way into EFT for a while. I learned it in the Enthusiastic Sobriety programs from the cult leader's wife was real big into alternative therapies, and we all did all the tapping and all that stuff. And I don't really remember it making much of a difference.
From what I remember, like it put me at ease a little bit because I do suffer from, you know, just general anxiety and just shit in life. But aside from that, I was like, this is not helping. This is not doing any, this is not doing what I needed to do.
Yeah. So no licensed, educated psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors on staff, yet they're having you sit in these groups and talk about trauma and traumatic things that happened to you. And then people are allowed to use it against you as ammunition.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
Okay. All right. Yep. That sounds really familiar. that happened in Enthusiastic Sobriety programs too. Okay. So that's bonkers. So you were there from what, sophomore year to senior year?
Pretty much. I did 3 years though, because when you go there, typically, I don't know about nowadays, but typically back then they made you coming into the year that you're coming out of repeat that year.
Okay.
So instead of just doing like going into my junior, senior, I did sophomore again, junior, senior.
Okay. So were you doing actual schoolwork? Were you like, did you have school that you did?
So we did when I wasn't in trouble. We did have class, but academics were an absolute joke.
So education was also used as a punishment.
Correct. When you were on punishment, they had a term for it being on 2-4. When you're on 2-4, basically you don't go to class.
I wish that people could see my face right now because I'm like, it's a school. Like its main,
we can't go to class.
Right. Its main function is used as a punishment. So this is not a school. This is not a behavioral treatment center. This is just basically a bunch of kids that pay to come do lots of work around the property for them, essentially.
Pretty much. Yeah. When I look back on it, that's what I remember most is like shoveling snow in winter, raking leaves in fall, you know, in springtime we're picking dandelions in the football field and, you know, doing other shit like that.
Right. So what was the percentage of people who were in trouble and not allowed to eat real meals or go to school, and as compared to the people who were doing well and actually getting what they paid for out of that place?
At any given time, I'd say there was always a group of kids out to work. There was always at least 5 to 10 kids that were out to work at any given time, I'd say.
Okay.
They had the students. It was pretty much like student run, they tried to make it. So the faculty would give the seniors powers pretty much.
Basically, faculty. That's never good.
Yeah. So it was like peer run in that sense. So there was kind of that like incentive to some kids that were, they called it being on track and off track. I was considered off track. On track kids and me did not get along.
Right.
But the on-track kids, that was kind of like the incentive of the program was, you know, oh, you get to stay out of trouble and get, you know, what seems like accolades on your, you know, graduation shit, because they had their whole own separate graduation ceremony that they did. You could get, I think it was like a doctorate, a certificate, and a diploma of the program, of the Hyde's character education program.
Okay, so what about like an actual high school diploma? Did you get one of those?
So as far as that goes, I did. They did try to deny me it, though. They tried to tell me that I had to come back after I turned 18 to do another year. And my dad was just not having it at that point. He was like, my daughter did 5 years of high school. You know, there's no way you're not giving her a diploma. But they did have kids that would come back for, I think they called it post-grad, instead of going right to college. They'd come back and work as faculty. So there, I mean, there was a high school diploma. But I do believe that they were somehow able to get around giving kids a high school diploma, because there were quite a few kids that came back, I believe, in, you know, the terms of making things up to the school right after graduation. So I don't know necessarily if they had the credits or what it was, but I did get my high school diploma.
Okay. Do you feel like you did the amount of schoolwork you needed to do to get a high school diploma?
Absolutely not. Absolutely
right. That's not. Yeah. If you were always in trouble.
If you were to ask me to do basic, you know, arithmetic right now, I probably couldn't do it. Algebra two, you know, all the stuff that, you know, is typical. You put it in front of me today and it's like a foreign language to me. I have no basis for it at all.
Right.
The whole way that I even passed my classes, I remember specifically my teachers would tell me that if I could explain to them every problem, how you would do it, even if I get it wrong, I'd get half a point for each one that I could do that with. And that's how I passed my finals.
Got it.
So I pretty much like bargained my way through finals by just showing, hey, I'm not a complete dumbass. You know, I have some intelligence, but I can't actually do the work.
Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of in shock still.
I was definitely in for a shock going to college. I'll tell you that much. My first year in college taking prerequisites, I was completely at a loss.
I'm sure.
I felt like I had no education.
Yeah. So you had teachers. Did you feel like the teachers cared about your education or cared about you? Like, was there ever anyone you felt like actually gave a shit about you?
Not really. Now that I look back on it in retrospect, I look at my, you know, when you say people that care about you, it's like people that you can still, like, in my mind, reach out to if need be. That's what I consider someone caring about you to be. And there's probably, honestly, maybe two teachers that left within the first few years of me being there, early on, that I would say I believe cared about me, because to this day, you know, we still correspond with each other. But aside from that, it was, no, education was not first and foremost. You know, it was pretty much, I felt like the education that I did get was just on a need-be basis. Like, there's no way that we could get by her getting out of the school without her knowing this kind of thing.
Got it. Yeah. So it just sounds really like lonely and isolating.
Yeah, that sounds pretty accurate.
Like, did you make any friends there? Did you feel like you had any allies at all?
I look back on that time and I honestly, like, I was close with people, I thought. But then my senior year came when I kind of pretty much became the dog shit of the school, because my senior year, they actually demoted me and called me a 12th grader, because there's a difference at Hyde between being a 12th grader and a senior. 12th grader means you're the dog shit of the school. Senior means, you know, you get the accolades, you're a part of the program, you're doing everything you need to. So I was a 12th grader. And I just remember that year specifically being really just a roller coaster, but also one of the loneliest times of my life, because I used to think that I was so close to people. And that year really showed me that, like, a program can make someone alter the way that they treat you, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So tell me about your senior year, because you've mentioned it a couple times and that it was rough. So tell me what happened there.
I had a boyfriend when I was at Hyde for a majority of my time there. And he was actually accused of raping my best friend during my senior year.
Yikes.
It was a whole, yeah, it was a, a whole thing. I was interviewed by state troopers. You know, of course, nothing ever came of it because, you know, places like Hyde, I'd love to, you know, make sure things like that don't become
quiet,
public knowledge.
Quiet that down. Yeah.
Exactly. But that happened. And I just remember walking around the school because it was known, apparently, that he cheated on me with this girl. So I was just walking around. And I can remember how lonely and how awkward and like alienated I felt that everyone knew before me. And all, the whole time, everyone's just coming up to me, you know, before everything, you know, shit ended up hitting the fan over it. But I just remember everyone coming up to me and being like, oh my God, Rachel, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I, you know, and in my head, I'm like, how are we playing the same sports with each other, you know, on the same teams and all this, that, and the third? And nobody could tell me this before it just getting out to the whole school kind of thing. Like, nobody was going to pull me to the side and be like, hey, I think you need to talk to your boyfriend and I think you need to talk to so-and-so because this is going to come out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awful.
So the rest of my senior year, it was just, it was really lonely and isolating. Aside from that happening, I was also the dog shit of the school, as I mentioned, which meant that I had gotten demoted. So I wasn't treated like the rest of the kids. I, by choice, was not participating in the senior aspect of the Hyde School program. So I was basically targeted a lot. They would hold a lot of concern meetings for me where people would just kind of rip me to shreds. And that kind of thing. And then the only highlight to my senior year, to be honest, was when I got kicked out. I got kicked out in 2008, a week before my graduation. And I just remember that meeting with the headmistress and my father being like the happiest moment of my life. At the same time, I was being ripped to shreds and told what a horrible human being I am. And, you know, I'm never going to amount to anything in life and this, that, and the third. But, you know, I called that my freedom day because that was the day that, you know, they finally realized that, you know, all right, we can't do anything with this one. You know, she's a lost cause, according to them.
Right. Yeah. So was there, did you ever feel like there was anyone who was like on your side? Like, at all? I mean, it just sounds so awful.
I mean, I did have two close guy friends, that to this day, one of them, unfortunately, you know, committed suicide. So he's not with me anymore, but I do I do have one of my other friends that, you know, we're still in touch to this day that looking back on it, I really appreciate him for being there for me as much as he could while at the same time doing what he, you know, he needed to do for himself while we were where we were.
And did you, like, did you connect with any of the other, like, troublemakers or?
I would say I did. You know, there's always that little bonding moment when it's like, oh, you think it's fuck this place too? And then, you know, in unison, it's like, yeah, fuck this place. So yeah. There was always, you know, moments like that. But it was far and few in between because the premise that they put you out to work under is usually like, for instance, a majority of the time I got put out to work was during what they call the school bust, where it's pretty much they just have kids standing up in the auditorium snitching people out. They put you on the bleachers and it's, you know, all the honest kids that are sitting in the audience are just like, well, I know you did this and I know you did this and I know you did this. And it,
like what kinds of things? Like, what were they calling people out on?
They had rules and ethics, which were basically like codes of conduct while you were at Hyde. You couldn't smoke, you couldn't drink, you couldn't gamble, you couldn't cheat on, you know, homework and stuff like that. You couldn't have sex, you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that. You know, you can't be a teenager.
So no sexual activities allowed at all?
No, it was not supposed to be allowed.
Okay. So like, would you have like with your boyfriend, did you have to kind of keep it secret that he was your boyfriend?
I mean, it was pretty known just based on the fact that, you know, I spent a lot of time with him. It was known that we were dating and that we were both from New York. So, you know, obviously, you know, people would take pictures, you know, on the bus and back then they were, the developable camera.
Right. Yeah.
So, people would develop pictures and, you know, suddenly there's a picture on MySpace of, you know, Rachel and this one, you know, kissing or something like that. So it was a known thing that we were dating. which definitely didn't help anything, to be honest, because when they know you're dating someone, obviously you're more of a target.
So you did have access to the internet?
No, our internet was very, we had like access, when I say MySpace, like, when we were home on break, if you get to go home for break, you have access to MySpace.
Got it.
But when
Got
we were
it.
At school, we only had email really, and they would have like firewalls that block anything that wasn't allowed.
Yeah. So it was like an intranet. Yeah. It wasn't an internet.
Yeah,
it was an intranet. Yeah. Got it. It was internal network. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have so many questions based on everything you just said. Okay. So how often were you allowed to go home?
So going home could be, like you could go home for the weekend if your parents asked, you know, permission for you to come home for the weekend, or typically it was just for holidays. So like Thanksgiving break, Christmas break, spring break, things like that. But if your behavior was particularly bad, you didn't usually get to go home for your breaks.
So you never went home, is what you're saying.
No, that was the one thing that I did get to do, was I did get to go home for breaks.
Okay, good.
Did, for some reason, I wasn't the worst of the worst when it came down to, you know, my attitude. Being defiant was always my thing. But right. In terms of like, you know, we had kids that would sell drugs and this, that, and the third. Or for instance, if your parents knew that you were going to get into trouble on break, they could ask if you could stay over break. So, you know, there were different reasons that kids didn't go home for break. Some, you know, some kids sometimes were international students that had to stay for break. But
right.
No, thankfully I did get to go home for breaks. For some reason, I wasn't the worst around those times.
So international students, so they had.
Yeah, we also have had international students at Hyde.
Good Lord. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
It always boggled me how international people found out about it, but
well, yeah, we had kids, it looks like they
Turkey,
have a,
Japan.
Yeah, they have a good marketing team, so I can imagine. So what were your conversations with your parents like when you would go home? I imagine you probably had lost a lot of weight.
Yes, I lost weight. Typically my conversations with my parents, we didn't really have conversations, unfortunately.
Okay.
My parents and my relationship have always been kind of estranged, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there would be times that, you know, I would have my, you know, moments of trying to communicate with them and explain to them, you know, how horrible it was. And it just was kind of the same responses, you know, over the phone. It's kind of like, you know what, I have to go do this right now. I, you know, we'll talk about this later, kind of thing.
And it, that later never came.
Yeah, because pretty much what happens on your breaks is they have these things called regional meetings, which are basically like, I'm from NYC. So we had a regional meeting for the students that lived close by to the area. So even when you're not at school on like holiday breaks, for instance, they would still have these gatherings where the parents were supposed to be included in it as well.
So you were still participating in Hyde school activities even when you were home on break?
Correct. They'd have regional meetings, you could call them.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So did your parents ask you anything about your weight loss or like how it was going, or did you guys just really not talk?
We really didn't talk. I got to a point with them that, you know, looking back in retrospect, I can see it partially has to do with their age and the fact that I'm adopted and we just never.
That's right. Your parents are much older.
Yeah, my parents are a lot older and I'm also adopted. So that thrown into the mix of everything, we've just never really had a close bond. But it was never them asking me. It was really me more trying to communicate that, you know, please, is there any other option? You know, I'm willing to try anything if you just give me an option.
And they just said no.
It was pretty much, you know, yeah, we'll look into it. I remember my junior year, my mom came up for what they called a FLC, a family learning center, which is like a 3-day weekend where your family members come up for participating in the program. They're supposed to have their own form of like dealing with the program kind of thing. And we had spoken about me possibly going to other schools, but at that point, their option was still boarding school. So I kind of figured, you know what?
The devil, you know.
Yeah, I was like, you know what? If this is my experience so far, I've got 1 year left. I, you know, am making this work for me so far somehow.
I imagine the participation the parents had was not raking leaves in the winter, though, right?
Oh, definitely not. It looked beautiful, though, whenever they came up. I will give them that. They definitely know how to dress up for the occasion of having parents.
I can only imagine. So, okay, so it's your senior year. There's the rape allegation. You feel ostracized from people you thought you could trust. What else was going on your senior year?
Oh, man. What was going on senior year? I forget what else happened that year, to be honest. I just have all these things from just my time there flying back. But senior year was supposed to be the year that I was like really excited for college. I remember that. And I just remember absolutely dreading it because I had no idea how I was going to function in college after this, because I knew where I was wasn't the real world per se.
Right.
But at the same time it was, and that was all that I had known for the past 3 years kind of thing. So college absolutely scared the shit out of me, to be honest.
Yeah.
I had no idea how I was going to make it in college, in the real world, anything like that. I was absolutely terrified.
Yeah. I can't even imagine. So you graduate, you get your diploma. So I assume you moved out at that point, correct?
I did. So when I left Hyde, I came home for a little bit and then I went right to college. So I ended up dorming at college again. So I didn't live at home straight. There was like just a little transition period where I lived at home pretty much. And then I just went straight off to dorm at college.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Concordia College in Bronxville, New York.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah. So you're at college, you're in a dorm. What was that like? Like, what was it like being back in the real world for the first time in 3 years?
It was awesome at first because I had decided to go to college with my best friend at the time. And I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. You know, it was pretty much, you know, I get to experience life now. I get to do what I wasn't able to do these past 3 years.
Yeah. Total freedom.
Yeah. So it was fun, but man, those classes, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Classes were strangers. I don't think I made it to class more than maybe like a month's worth of time at any given time, because me and class just never got along. You know, I was never in class. I never had that structure of going to class and sitting there for 8 hours a day. You know, it was rough.
Yeah. So did you start like drinking and getting high? And like, was that why you weren't going to class? Or was it just like, I don't care?
It was pretty much, I don't care. It was more so, you know what? I want to find a job. I want to, you know, make my own money. I want to, you know, I want to live. I don't want to keep feeling like I'm in a school. That was my big thing. After Hyde, I just was so repelled by the thought of school.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. So did you graduate college? Like, did you do well? Did you drop out? What happened?
No, I ended up dropping out of college. I went for my first year, and then I think I actually got asked not to come back because I was in school. I was in school for such a little amount of time that they were like, you know what, you can't live for free in our dorm room. You can't just live on campus.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure they asked me not to come back, which wasn't terrible. I didn't really like that school anyway, but it was a great school. Nothing against the school. Just me in school. Just, you know, don't get along. So I just went right back to working.
Okay. So what have you done since then? So you left Hyde in 2008?
Eight. Yes.
Okay. And then you did a year of college. And then, so what have you been doing the past 12 years? Like, what has your life looked like?
I've been homeless. I've worked a ton of different jobs. I finally got the career that I wanted.
Which is what?
Yeah. I work for the New York State Office of Mental Health currently.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. It's pretty fun. Well, I shouldn't say fun. That makes it sound like a lax job, but.
Right.
No, it's a great job and it's a career, which is the most important thing to me. It's stable. It's, you know, it's something that I can look forward to doing. It's an outlet for me, honestly. It gives me something different to experience in the world. And honestly, like it gives me moments that remind me of Hyde. And in this sense, now that I'm working as a job for it, it's more that I can find outlets and ways that I can help.
Right.
So I really like it.
Good. I'm glad. And what about like, so have you done any kind of therapy or anything since you left there? Or like how did you get started thinking about your time at Hyde and being like, that was really fucked up?
So to be honest, a lot of it was when I was homeless. Mm-hmm. I was transitionally homeless, you know, for years. And recently within the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, it's, you know, I've been having more recent bouts of it, you know, where I'm not having a stable living situation and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. And just everyone I met, you know, everyone always tells me that, you know, the stories that I have to tell, as people refer to them as stories, you know, a lot of people they can't believe that they're real. So mm-hmm. a lot of what that's done for me is it's made it more so for me, I guess, to check my own sanity kind of thing. Like, mm-hmm. yeah. I'm not crazy. These things really did happen, right? Like,
right.
So that's kind of where my healing journey has started. Just basically making sure that, you know, I know what happened to me happened kind of thing, you know,
right.
Like it's not something that I made up or anyone else has made up or anything of that sort. So my healing journey has been, it's been a long one, but it's getting there finally, I'd like to say. Like, just even finding you in this podcast and, you know, with Breaking Code Silence, I wrote like a testimonial for them and things of that sort. Like, this is like really the first time that I've ever, I think, stopped in life and actually reflected on the fact that I went to Hyde even.
Right. Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot to kind of process, because when you're there, you're just surviving. Like, mm-hmm. you're just like dealing with day to day. And so you just can't think about it that deeply. And then,
exactly,
you know, with everything you went through when you first left, with going to college and then trying to figure out your life and how you're going to make money and all that kind of stuff. You can't look at it. You can't deal with it. And then, yeah, something like this will bring it to the surface. Cause there's a lot of Hyde survivor accounts on Instagram. And I've seen some really hellish stories from people, especially some of the men. It sounds like the men's side was like Lord of the Flies. Like,
yeah, and that's the other thing that I'm realizing too, is that since there's so many of these, you know, survivor pages and things of that sort, I'm just kind of like, it's making me realize, you know, that, man, I should really reconnect with some of the people I've went with, even if they have no interest connecting with me, just to make sure that they're okay. Because I don't think a lot of people realize how much going through that stuff, as mm-hmm. minuscule as it may seem then, or, you know, at any given point, it's not normal. It's not stuff that should be happening on a day-to-day basis to teenagers. It's not an equation for positivity.
It's not helpful. It's not helping anybody.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I don't think that a lot of Hyde people even consider that, to be honest. Like, I've had a few people reach out to me since, you know, I've done my activists, as I like to call it, work or whatever. But they've reached out to me and said, you know, holy shit, you know, I never even realized that, you know, I felt any kind of way about getting sent to Hyde. To me, it was mm-hmm. just boarding school back then. But hearing you and, you know, other people speak out about, you know, their time there and their experiences made me realize that, like, wait a minute, I have some stories of my own that I didn't think about before as anything significant.
Right. Yeah. I've had the same thing. I mean, for me, it was I talked about this on our Twitch stream yesterday. It was such a like slow process of like uncovering more and more, and me coming to terms more and more with like, oh, that's really fucked up and that's not normal. And, you know, mm-hmm. To the point where I am today, where I'm standing up and saying like, none of it was okay. But there have been people that have contacted me after listening to the podcast or, you know, reading some of the stuff on our website, things like that. And they said like, I'm back in therapy because I had never stop to think about how messed up all that stuff was, you know? And now that I'm seeing like the effects it's had on my life, I'm seeking out help, you know?
Yeah.
And what do you see as like some of the long-term effects of being there? Like what are the things that maybe still come up or, you know, that you've been able to identify started because you were there?
I would definitely, I hate to admit it, but a lot of my violent outbursts that I've had in life stem from Hyde and just, you know, being, you know, pushed into a room or restrained in some way in that in that manner. You know, like, for instance, there was a time that I was going to, you know, get into a fist fight with someone, and I was shoved and held into a room. And I've realized that a lot of my adverse reaction to being contained or restrained mm-hmm. in any form or fashion comes from that. My, you know, PTSD and CPTSD have definitely not been helped from it at all. You know, mm-hmm. kids living in the woods and having panic attacks. Like, I had a severe panic attack my first night, to the point that I'm pretty sure I blacked out and cried myself to sleep that night. Mm-hmm. That's not normal for a body to go through, you know, mm-hmm. Especially a teenager, because I read a quote somewhere that said something like, you know, although my brain may forget the trauma, my body never does. That's yep. absolutely true. Like yep. that's so true. Like I distinctly to this day remember every single winter that I've spent when I was homeless, or like, you know, when nights that I didn't have a place to go or whatever, and being grateful that at least I wasn't in Eustis, Maine in the middle of a blizzard.
Oh God. So you wait, hold on. So they had you out in the woods camping alone in the winter?
It wasn't alone. They sent like a group of kids at one time. So there'd be like, let's say 5 to 10 of us at any given, on any given group. And what they would do is at night, they would blindfold you from the main campsite and walk each kid in different directions, so nobody knew where anyone else was. So we weren't really alone, but we were alone in that sense that they pretty much made you think that I was just blindfolded and walked to God knows where.
What? So, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. So was there adult supervision out there while you guys were out there?
There was, but it was minimal, you could say. Like, we were, you know, blindfolded and walked to our spot, but there was no adult watching me once I was put in my spot that night. The adults went back to the main campsite.
Oh my God. So did you have fire? Did you have any way to keep warm?
No, no. We were given 2 large tarps. We had our sleeping bag, our sleeping mat, you know, the wilderness kind of gear. And that was it. But the wilderness instructors slept in like yurts with fire. So like during the day, for instance, one of the activities they made us do is like we'd chop down firewood and carry firewood back for them.
Wait, so you didn't have a tent?
No, we made our own shelter out of the 2 tarps.
In the middle of a blizzard?
Yeah, in the middle of winter.
Oh my God. And this is while you're yeah. also only eating trail mix.
Correct. And I remember one time that trip, I got hot chocolate as a good behavior treat. And it stayed hot for about half an hour. And I was instructed to sleep with it near my, like under my clothes, because my body heat would keep it warm.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And how many times did you have to do that?
I was there in winter, I want to say 2, because I was also there a few times in like the springtime or whatever. But winter, I was there 2.
So that's punishment for what? Being defiant?
The first time I ever got sent there was because I lied about smoking a cigarette.
Okay.
And I refused to cop to it, basically.
Okay. What was the second time for?
The second time was for leadership building. They decided that I was not embracing my unique potential, as they like to call it, and being the leader that they knew I could be. So they sent me to the woods, not necessarily as punishment, but as, you know, a leadership trip to encourage and build my character into more of a leader.
Okay. So they've got a bunch of kids who are acting out and obviously have stuff going on, potentially mental illness. Mm-hmm. And they're having them dredge up all their deep, dark secrets and like potentially traumatic things that have happened to them mm-hmm. with no therapy and no professional mm-hmm. to help them work through it. And then they're sending them out into the wilderness alone. And that's supposed to be character building?
Correct. It's supposed to, you know, bring out your unique potential and, oh you God. Know, make you the best you can be.
I can't even process that. I don't even know what to say about that. That's child abuse. I mean, that's all that yep, that is.
That it is.
Oh my God. Okay. Wow. Yeah, that's a lot. So are you in any kind of therapy now? It sounds like you've gotten some diagnoses of PTSD and CPTSD. How are you like kind of handling all of that these days?
These days I deal day to day, you could say. Every day I'm still finding that balance between it being a good day and a not so good day. But as far as like, you know, my mental health and everything, I'm still in therapy, you know, for it. I still am looking for the best therapist for me at this time, because unfortunately I keep having them, you know, oh, I'm no longer working here. So I'm going here. And so that whole kind of merry-go-round with the mental health system. But aside from that, you know, I'm still on my journey. I'm still figuring out how to process everything, you could say, because even still to this day, things come up and I'm like, where did that even come from? Why did I think about that? You know, that kind of thing. So it's still a work in progress, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, same here. I mean, a lot of us are still, hello, Kitty. A lot of us are still in therapy and we're still working on our mental health and we're still trying to figure out, you know, how to deal with PTSD and trauma and the consequences of all that. It's just, it's hard, you know?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of us are still estranged from our families, or our families still don't understand, or, you know, I mean, it causes so many problems with just our lives in general. So that's completely understandable. And so what would you say to another HIDE survivor listening to this, like who, you know, is maybe this is the first time they've even started to look at like what happened to them?
I would just tell them to, you know, I'm tempted to say one of, you know, the HIDE sayings, which is, you know, if the shoe fits, wear it, if not, throw it away, because a lot of what people I've noticed have the first reaction of is that, you know, it wasn't that bad, you know, or oh, that didn't happen. And it's kind of just like, you know, take a moment and actually think about what you can remember from that place, even if it's the most minuscule thing ever. And think of that if it's got to do with, you know, I don't know, because I like a lot of the things that have been coming back to me, I look at and I'm kind of just like, that really, really wasn't okay. And it's helped shape my morals and characters even up till today. And I would honestly just say, you know, kind of think of it in a non-HIDE way, like from an outsider's perspective, almost like look at it honestly and give it that honest moment of thought, because a lot of what went on there really, really wasn't okay.
Yeah.
Even the minuscule things that I can think of, I look back at, and at this point I'm like, I wish there was a logical adult around.
Yeah.
Because it would have made a world of a difference to have someone that wasn't from HIDE at HIDE.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think too, you know, especially if they have kids, like imagine
your kid at HIDE. And it's funny you say that, actually, because a lot of kids from HIDE have kids now. And a lot of the ones that I've spoken to, you know, when I've asked them, honestly, when, you know, HIDE comes up in conversation, I'll ask them, you know, would you honestly send your kid to HIDE? And I have yet to come across someone that said yes.
Yeah. Like imagine your child being taken out in the wilderness in the winter in Maine and blindfolded and given a handful of trail mix to eat for the week and with two tarps and like, good luck. And not knowing where anyone else is and not knowing where they are. Like, would you do that to your child?
Exactly.
You know, like there's a podcast called Confronting Columbine. And it's about this woman who was a survivor of the Columbine shootings. And, you know, at the time, like in the early 90s, you know, we didn't really have trauma-informed therapy. And there weren't a lot of people, like school shootings were still such a new thing that it was like, well, be glad you're alive was pretty much the message that she got. Like, be glad you made it.
Yeah.
And she never really dealt with any of the trauma until she dropped her daughter off at school for the first time. And she had a panic attack. And she went to the hospital and they were like, you're having a panic attack. And they asked her, like, you know, have you ever had any traumatic events in your life? And she was like, no, not really. And the more they talked to her, she was like, well, I was at Columbine. And they were like, whoa, like, that's a traumatic event. Like, that's a big deal. And it was the first time that it really opened her eyes. So imagine someone who's in something, experiences something like that, you know, 20 years later has still not been able to admit that it was a traumatic event and that there might be some stuff, you know, they need to look at. And then, you know, those of us who went through these kind of institutional child abuse programs that are billed as behavioral health and mental health and drug treatment. And we don't think like that was abuse. Like, we just don't, it's hard to look at it that way, you know, and exactly. Deal with it. So yeah, I mean, I love what you said, and I think you're right. Like take yourself outside of the experience and apply it to someone that you care about. Even if it, you know, if it's a kid or if it's a niece or nephew or a friend's kid, like, and imagine how you would feel if you knew they were going through what you went through when you were there. That's a great way, you know, to look at that. So, and, you know, like I said, there's a lot of, hide survivors on Instagram. What's the name of the account that I was contacted by?
It would be the Hyde School Survivors page.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at Instagram too.
Hyde School_Survivors.
Yep, there it is. I see it now. Hyde School_Survivors. Yeah. So go check them out on Instagram. You know, connect with some of your former classmates, connect with some of the people who are speaking out. You know, these places, there has to be some accountability. We've got to start, you know, finding some justice for all of you. And stop, you know, that's what really got me, pushed me into activism with, you know, Bob Meehan's programs, is because I was hearing stories of kids who were currently there and the abuse was worse. And I was like, okay, I can't sit back and not say anything now. I've got to do whatever I can to, you know, bring some exposure and accountability to these people, because it needs to stop. So
absolutely.
I'm glad that y'all are starting to speak out, and I am absolutely, you know, we've had some success with, you know, exposing some of the stuff going on, in Bob Meehan's programs. You know, we're, the nonprofit Enthusiastic Sobriety Abuse Alliance, they're doing some really good work with, they've got a mass complaint form, and, they're going to start filing complaints with ethics committees in the cities where, these programs operate. And, you know, they're doing some really good work. So, and I worked with them a lot in the very beginning. So, you know, we have this formula for ways to start to, you know, shine some light on these programs. So I am happy to help in any way I can. Love to have any of you guys on the podcast, love to work with you to start to, you know, reach out to the media and do whatever we can to, you know, shed light on these people and, you know, hopefully get them shut down, you know?
I like the sound of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So this has been awesome. Is there anything else that, you know, you want to talk about or you want to say before we close?
Not that I could think of. If any of my, you know, fellow Hyde alumni are listening, hey, what's up? I hope you guys are doing well.
Yeah, me too. I hope they're doing well. And it's been great talking to you. I've really, really enjoyed having you on. So
yes.
And thank you
so much for having me.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on, and thank you to all of our listeners. If you, you know, have any questions for Rachel, or, you do want to reach out to her, do you want to, put any of your contact information, in the show notes, or they can reach out to me and I can pass it along to you?
Sure. Either or works.
Okay. Okay. The email for the podcast is onthemspod@gmail.com if you want to get in touch with Rachel. And then we'll put some information in the show notes. So all you do is just tap on the description in Apple Podcasts, and it will open up those show notes, and you'll be able to see that. So all right. Well, thanks again. And
thank you so much.
Listeners, we will see you later. Bye.
Bye.
And that was Rachel. So I really, really like Rachel. I think she's just a sweetheart, and she's just come so far, and I'm so happy for her and what she's, you know, the line of work she's in now, and it's just so awesome. So any other Hyde survivors that are listening, you know, if you want to come on the podcast and tell your story, I am happy to have you. We can, you know, we don't have to use your name. We can alter your voice. Or, you know, on the other hand, we don't have to do that. We could record video of us talking, or you can even, you know, come and be live on Twitch with me. So it just depends on your level of comfortability, and I'm flexible and can do it, you know, however, whatever makes you feel the most comfortable. So, happy to do that. We're, you know, let's shut them all down. Let's get the truth out there about all of them. So thank you all for listening. Thank you so much. I hope that you have a very safe and happy new year. And I'll see you the first week in January. If you like the podcast, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. And I just heard that you can't use Apple Podcasts on Android phones. So if you have an Android phone, I guess you can't rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, but you can rate and review it on Spotify. You have to listen to a couple of them first before they'll let you, but that's another place where you can leave a review. And if you don't like the podcast, or you have some feedback for me that's, you know, critical, that's something you don't like about the podcast, I am here for it. Just don't blast me in a review. Send me an email at onthemspod@gmail.com or DM me on Instagram or call the hotline, and you can leave an anonymous message. Just be nice. And, you know, ultimately this podcast is here to help survivors of any of these programs that, you know, say that they help families and really they destroy them. So, you know, having good ratings and good reviews is really helpful because it gets eyeballs on our content, and it, you know, there could be something that someone says on one of these podcasts that just changes someone's life. And there already has been. I've already heard from people who said, you know, there are things that they had never even considered until they listened to some of the stories told here. So I want to be able to keep that happening. So if you are unhappy with something I do, please let me know. I'm happy to hear that. You know, just don't leave a 1-star review, because that's not helpful for anybody. So I hope everybody has a great end of the year, and we will see you in 2022. Bye.